Earlier this month, the fundamentalist Sunni group ISIS attacked the Yazidis, a religious minority who live in northwest Iraq, forcing tens of thousands of them into the mountains to escape persecution. It prompted President Obama to order airstrikes against ISIS, using military force in a country where he had been reluctant to intervene. The episode was the first time many Americans had even heard of the Yazidis, one of the many religious communities living in the Middle East. On this week's Please Explain, we thought that we would learn more about these communities, the Alawites, Baha'i, Azalis, Sufis, Kurds, Druze, the Ahmadiyya Muslims. Our guide is Zachary Lachman, professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at NYU. He has served as president of the Middle East Studies Association and currently is a contributing editor to Middle East Report. And we invite our listeners to join the conversation during these Please Explain segments. You can call us at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Professor Lachman, welcome to our show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The former U.S. diplomat Peter Galbraith has reported that President George W. Bush didn't know there was a difference between Sunni and Shiite Muslims as late as January 2003, and I suspect the president wasn't alone at that time. How different are the ideologies of the Sunni and the Shia?
Well, as always, it's a complicated question. The difference between Sunnis and Shiis began as a political dispute about the succession to the Prophet Muhammad. When the Prophet Muhammad died in 632, and he was already then the political as well as the spiritual leader of a community of believers that was expanding its control over much of Arabia and would go on to carve out a vast empire, there was disagreement about who should succeed him. There were those who argued that the succession should take place within the family of the Prophet. He had no male children who survived, so they argued that his replacement, the Khalifa, the Caliph, which simply means successor, should be Ali, his son-in-law and cousin, one of his first followers, and then Ali's descendants. In fact, Ali was passed over, and the first three Caliphs were leading figures in the community among Muhammad's leading companions. But this touched off an ongoing dispute about the succession.
And the followers of Ali are the Shiites, and the others are the Sunni. And the Sunni are pretty much the dominant group. They represent up to 90% of all Muslims. So they won that battle, didn't they?
They did win that battle. Ali himself, who became actually the fourth caliph, was assassinated. There was a civil war. And the enemies of Ali took over and created a hereditary dynasty. So the followers of Ali came to feel that the leadership of the Muslim community had been usurped. Something went very wrong almost from the beginning, and that they were the guardians of the correct tradition.
Did they disperse and live in separate regions of the Middle East as a result?
It wasn't so much a dispersal. They were, and again, this is a complicated story. For periods, there was persecution of the followers of Ali. Originally, it was a political issue, but of course took on religious overtones, such that over the centuries, and there are different kinds of Shiis as well, developed their own distinctive practices, different legal texts, different traditions to some extent, but often coexistence. So it's always a mixture.
Although the Shia live pretty much in four countries, Iran, Pakistan, India, and Iraq.
Yes.
And then a smaller group in Lebanon, marginalized for many years, although with the growing power of Hezbollah, the Shiites have become a major force there as well.
Yes, but again, it's something that has shifted over the centuries. Iran was a Sunni country until the 16th century, when a new dynasty took over, and for political reasons in part, to differentiate itself from the Sunni Ottoman Empire, imported Shi'i clerics from Lebanon and made Iran the Shi'i country that it has become today.
So that's a fairly recent Shiite country, and many people have suggested that Iran's Shi'ism, is unique because it's also so tinged with Zoroastrianism, whereas the other Shiite countries are not.
I'm not sure there's much of a Zoroastrian element. In Iran, Shiism has become very closely identified with Iranian national identity. It is, in a sense, a national religion, although there are non-Shiis in Iran as well.
Now, the ISIS, or the Islamic State, is calling itself the new caliphate. What are the origins of the caliphate? Does it begin with with the Prophet Muhammad?
Exactly. When he dies, his community deals with the question of who will succeed him as the political and, to an extent, spiritual leader. And again, from the beginning, there are arguments, disputes, and even conflicts over this.
And how were they chosen? Was there some kind of a council that voted?
It seems to have been the elders of the community who chose the first four caliphs. After that, it becomes, with the defeat of the supporters of Ali, it becomes a hereditary monarchy, in a sense, based in Damascus.
And how long does that last?
That goes on for some centuries. In the mid-18th, 8th century, there was a new dynasty which took over, which deposed the first one and then ruled for several centuries more. The last widely recognized caliph was killed by the Mongols when they seized Baghdad in 1258.
Are there any resemblances between the caliphates of the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries and the caliphate that ISIS wants to create now?
Well, the claim of the current self-proclaimed caliph to that position is highly dubious from any traditional Islamic legal perspective. Among other things, the caliph is supposed to be a member of the tribe of, or descended from the tribe of, that Muhammad belonged to, the Quraysh. And although he calls himself Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi al-Qurayshi, he has added that it seems most unlikely that there's any descent there.
My guest is Zachary Lachman, professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at NYU, and we're talking about the various religions of the Middle East on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and a reminder that you're invited to join in the conversation by calling us at 212-433-9692 or writing to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. The new caliphate is imposing what they're calling Sharia law. Is there any one Sharia law, or does this vary according to who? Does the Quran lay it out?
No, in this sense, Islam, or Sunni Islam especially, is very much like Judaism. There's no church, there's no hierarchy, there's no pope to decree that this is the correct line. So over the centuries, jurists, scholars developed this vast body of law, and different jurists adopted different positions, and that's recognized and even institutionalized.
And then is there a greater split also when we're looking at Sunnis and Sharia? Shiites in terms of Sharia?
Again, there's some overlap and there's some differences. So over the centuries, Shi'i jurists, of course, focused on certain things rather than others, adopted or recognized certain sayings of the Prophet as authoritative and ignored other ones.
And then we can look at the Wahhabis, the Taliban, the ISIS, and compare them to some liberal Sunnis, and we get very different Islams.
Absolutely. It's a very diverse tradition, like Christianity, like Judaism. There are people who go back to the sources, and they pick and choose certain things and then fashion them into an ideology that in many ways does not reflect the diversity of the tradition. And in recent years, we've seen these very extreme, hardline, and brutal interpretations of Islam.
And that's why many people in the West see Sharia law as linked to extremist groups and state repression?
That's probably why that image comes about. But Sharia law has historically was extremely flexible. Today, even, people joke about Muslims going fatwa shopping, that if they want a ruling on something, they go to some mufti. If they don't like the ruling, they go to a different mufti. And with the Internet, that's become really easy. People have always done this because it was such a diverse tradition and there was no central authority to say, this is the one way to think about this.
Well, since Islam covers such a wide swath of the earth, and we're talking about 1.57 billion people, how much of what people claim to be Sharia law is really based on local traditions? For example, things like wearing the veil, or in fact wearing a woman being covered from head to toe, mm-hmm. Or genital mutilation, those kinds of traditions.
So those kinds of things and many others are practiced in some places, but not in others. And even in places where they're practiced, there are ongoing disputes about them and arguments among jurists, among Muslims in general. Most Muslims, we tend to think of the Middle East as the center of the Muslim world, but in fact, there are many more Muslims in Indonesia than in the Middle East. In Indonesia, the practices are very different. It's a democracy. They're Muslim parties, but the vast majority of people vote for secular parties.
Indonesia being the most populous Muslim state, and then Pakistan second, and India, which is not even a Muslim state, has the third largest population.
That's right. And when the Soviet Union was in existence, it was also one of the most populous Muslim countries, in a sense.
A listener would like more clarification as to what Sharia law is. How does it work?
Well, it's again, a very diverse body of law. I think the best analogy might be Jewish law, right? Halakha, right, which developed over the centuries through conversations among rabbis, disputes, texts commenting on previous texts. And you have this vast corpus, which has many different things going on in it. In Sunni Islam, there are four recognized and mutually acknowledged legitimate schools of law with different rulings on many different kinds of things. So it's a vast body. It's really only in the modern period that people tried to turn it into a legal code in the way that we understand it. And states usually did that for their own particular purposes.
Zia-ul-Haq in Pakistan, for example.
Right.
But also Saudi Arabia claims to follow Sharia law. Is that why women can't drive cars? Did Muhammad make some kind of a ruling on that?
No. Well, there's obviously nothing about automobiles and women driving them in the Quran. This is something, again, the people who run Saudi Arabia have adopted a particular puritanical version of Islam, which emerged in the 18th century and which, at the time it emerged, was looked on with horror by most Muslims elsewhere.
It seems to me that we start off with the split, and then there are splits on top of the splits. There are the Sufis. Are the Sufis a form of Sunni Islam, or is it a totally different group?
It's not quite a group. It's more a tone, a sentiment. It cuts across all sorts of lines. In the pre-modern world, many, many people in the Ottoman Empire, from the Sultan down to the poorest peasants, often belonged to a Sufi order. These were sort of fraternities, lodges with their own practices. And they were a way for people, away from the legal texts, away from the narrow, dry rulings, to express their religiosity through popular piety, through all sorts of means.
But would a Sufi be a religious Sunni, do they draw upon too many other sources?
There were different forms of religious practice. So a very educated Muslim religious scholar in Damascus, for example, might look with disdain and some suspicion on the practices of a Sufi sheikh out in the countryside and not be very happy that they were going to the tombs of local holy men and engaging in these popular practices, which he might have thought were a little dubious. But the people engaging with them certainly thought of themselves as good Muslims and connecting with God and keeping with Islam.
The region is also home to Yazidis, Kurds, Zoroastrians, Baha'i, other minority religious groups, including Christians and less so Jews these days, but many of these countries also had strong Jewish minorities. Have all of the minorities been historically persecuted, or have they generally been left alone?
So it's a complicated story. So for long periods, during the Ottoman Empire, for example, which ruled much of this region since the 1500s.
That was a Sunni Muslim.
It was a Sunni Muslim state, but by and large, its rulers did not much care what their subjects did, what religion they practiced. As long as they paid their taxes and kept order, they didn't interfere. They didn't care what language they spoke and so on. Now, there were certainly periods of persecution of Shi'is by Sunnis, persecution sometimes of the Jewish minority and elsewhere. On the other hand, I think most scholars agree that the situation, for example, of the Jews in Muslim lands was far superior to the situation of the Jews in medieval Christian Europe.
That's until maybe the 20th century?
In the 20th century, things go downhill in some sense because you have the creation of nation states, and nations demand new forms of identity. Most of the states that were carved out, largely by the British and French at the end of the First World War, wanted all of their citizens to identify as Arabs, for example, and try to impose new kinds of identity on a very diverse population.
But even Arabic is a language that changes a lot. I've spoken to people from Northern Africa, Moroccans, for example, and they say that they really can't understand what an Egyptian is saying in many cases. Languages only have a bare resemblance to each other.
Well, it's true. There is a common written language, which is also used in certain forms of speech, informal speech, and so on, but the dialects vary a great deal.
Now, all of the Muslims of Africa would be Sunni, wouldn't they?
By and large, yes.
Are there variations among them as well, depending on the country that they're in? For example, now we've seen the development of Boko Haram in Nigeria. It would be very different than North African Islam, or even some of the practices of nearby sub-Saharan African countries.
Absolutely. I think in most cases, the popular practices certainly are inflected by local conditions and vary historically. And part of what we've seen is the effort by certain Sunni groups, for example, to try to stamp those things out, to impose a certain kind of puritanical uniformity. But again, that's a modern phenomenon.
Now, you mentioned the Ottoman Empire, which reshaped the religious makeup of the Middle East and parts of Europe. They, even though they were Sunni, they were a lot more tolerant of religious minorities?
By and large, when the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492 after the Catholic Reconquest, many of them went to the Ottoman Empire, where they were welcomed and settled among already existing Jewish communities because they were seen by the rulers of the Ottoman Empire as bringing skills in trade and crafts and so on. Now, again, toward the end of the Ottoman Empire's existence from the later 19th century, again, things get more complicated because that empire, too, in trying to struggle for its survival in a world dominated by European powers, saw the rise of elements which also tried to impose uniformity and ended up doing some awful things, the genocide of the Armenians, for example, during the First World War.
There is still some conflict in the Balkans as a result of the forced conversion of people many centuries ago to Islam.
Well, I'm not sure it's the forced conversion so much.
Well, that's what the
Serbs would say, exactly. But again, that tells us it's not so much sectarianism having primordial roots or going back many centuries, because until relatively recently, these peoples lived side by side with their differences and often interacted quite peaceably. It's modern nationalism, it's politics that has turned these differences into something people unfortunately kill or are killed about.
My guest is Zachary Lachman, professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at NYU. We're talking about the various religious communities of the Middle East on today's Please Explain. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Professor Zachary Lachman of the who teaches Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at NYU. We are talking about the various religious communities of the Middle East. And we invite your calls, of course, at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. What was the religious makeup of the region of Palestine before the 20th century?
Well, Palestine didn't exist as an administrative unit. It was sort of a geographical term for that area, very roughly defined.
Did the Ottoman Empire control it?
It was part of the Ottoman Empire, absolutely, but there was no Ottoman province of Palestine as such, although the term had been around for many centuries. The vast majority of the population was Arabic-speaking and was Muslim, Sunni Muslim, but there were substantial Christian and Jewish minorities, and then some others. There was a Druze population, another offshoot of Shia Islam that goes back many centuries, and various others.
Well, let's talk about the Druze. In fact, let's talk about the situation in Lebanon. There are a variety of Christian communities in Lebanon, and it's affected the politics of the country, as I understand it. The president is required to be a Maronite Christian. The prime minister is Sunni, and the speaker of the parliament is a Shiite. Was that a way of resolving some of the tensions?
Well, it may have resolved some tensions. It created others, which persist to this day. Again, it's a product of the 20th century. These diverse communities had lived in Lebanon, although there was no Lebanon within the borders we know it today. And in the pre-modern period, some of those identities were a little bit fuzzy, so that the ruler of Mount Lebanon, for example, it was a little difficult to tell. Some days he seemed to be a Maronite and other days a Druze, depending on his political interests.
Well, let's talk about the Druze. I remember the name Walid Jumblatt years ago, the leader of the Druze. Then I don't know if he's still.
He is.
are they an offshoot of Islam?
They are an offshoot of Shi'i Islam, of a particular form of Shi'i Islam, because Shi'i Islam is not one thing. The form of Shi'i Islam in Iran, for example, is not quite the same as other forms of Shi'i Islam. There's a variety there. The Ismailis, for example, the Aga Khan, whom people may have heard of, that's another sect. So the Druze have a substantial population. It's small, but because they're well organized and have been militarily successful, play an important role in the politics of Lebanon, but others in Syria and a few in Israel as well.
How did the Druze differ from other Muslims?
Well, they're not all Muslims agree that the Druze are even Muslims. So again, this is something that has shifted over time. I think today most Druze would say they are Muslims, but they are much more heterodox than mainstream Shi'is, for example.
Well, don't the Sunni and the Shia declare all of the offshoots as not really Muslim?
Not always. So again, there are the extremist forces. We see this with the Islamic State and to some extent the Wahhabi strain, as it's often called, that dominates Saudi Arabia, who tend to see non-Sunnis as really non-Muslims. But there's also a long tradition in many jurists among the Sunnis who said, yes, they're Muslims, there are problems with them, but we recognize them as Muslims even if they're erring Muslims.
What are the Kurds? They've been fighting for statehood for quite a while, mostly with Turkey, but they have a quasi-statehood right now in Iraq.
The Kurds are an ethnic group or a national group rather than a religious group. Most of them are Sunni, but they're Shi'i Kurds, and the Yazidis are quasi-Kurds in ethnic terms, even if religiously they have their own esoteric syncretic religion.
And how does their religion differ from other forms of Islam? Or is it even Islam?
It's not Islam. It may contain elements of popular Islam, of Sufism, but it also has a strong basis, apparently, in Zoroastrianism, and it pulls together things from other faiths as well, including many pre-Islamic faiths.
And then there are the Alawites. The President Assad of Syria is an Alawite. And one of the reasons people have said he has been holding out is because he fears that if the Sunni rebels finally win, the Alawites and some other minorities of Syria will be persecuted.
It's true. The Alawites compose about 10 or 15% of Syria's population, but they have dominated the regime, and the Assad regime has drawn very heavily for all the key positions in the security apparatus and the military on the Alawites. And the Alawi faith is also an offshoot of Shi'i Islam, which again went off in many different directions. And as you mentioned, there were splits over the centuries, and people then developed their own theological distinctions.
The Alawites drink wine, which is forbidden in other forms of Islam, although we hear about people drinking wine. They believe in a trinity of Muhammad, Ali, and Salman al-Farisi. Now, I know who Muhammad and Ali are. There we are with Shi'ism. Mm-hmm. But who is Salman al-Farisi?
He seems to have been a charismatic figure who was seen as a sort of a forerunner of Sufism in a sense. And at some point, he was drawn on to this sort of trinity. It's a very un-Islamic kind of idea because Islam holds to a pretty strict monotheism. But again, you have all these faiths, these small groups emerging with their own distinctive theologies.
Emerging because somebody comes along this is kind of like Martin Luther or some of the other leaders of Protestant groups, Calvin, etc., leading to Azalis, the Baha'is, the Ahmadiyyas in mm-hmm. Pakistan and India.
In some cases, there was probably a religious reformer, a charismatic figure. In the case of the Baha'is, that's a very new faith. So we actually know where that comes from pretty well. It's out of Iran in the 19th century, where a figure arose saying he was bringing a new revelation to fix the deformities of the society in which he lived. He was ultimately martyred, but then a group of his followers founded what became the Baha'i faith in the course of the 19th century. The others, their origins are lost in the mists of time. We can find historic references to them going back to a certain point, but beyond that, we don't know much. They probably survived because, again, this is very difficult terrain. It's possible for people to be up there in the mountains somewhere and hold on to their faith, and especially under pre-modern states, again, which don't much care that their subjects have these strange beliefs as long as they don't make trouble.
The first time I heard of the Ahmadiyyas was when there was a bombing in Pakistan by somebody who claimed that they were apostates. Are they Muslims?
Well, they think they're Muslims, but again, most of the many Sunni Muslims, and certainly, again, the more religious hardline parties in Pakistan do not think they're proper Muslims. And there have been very severe tensions in Pakistan between Muslim sects, the Sunni majority, and various Shi'i or Ahmadi minorities, often resulting in violence.
Listeners have been writing in. Linda from the Lower East Side is curious about the Muslim saints. How does that work? Are they folkloric, or are they canonized, or what?
Well, there's no process of canonization because there's no organized church as such. But popular Islam had its sort of holy men, clearly charismatic figures who lived a long time ago, who attracted a following. Sufism was often built around, the Sufi orders was built around some charismatic figure who then formed a lineage. And people felt that this person could intercede on their behalf with God in a sense. They had a certain grace that people could partake of either through direct contact or through, for example, as in the case in popular Catholicism, praying at their tombs. And the countryside was full of, down to the modern era, full of saints' tombs, for example, where people would go on pilgrimage, women who wanted to get pregnant, people who wanted to get healed from their illnesses, and so on. Now, again, this was frowned upon by the more sort of orthodox, urban, educated, Sunni jurists, but it was very much a feature of popular Islam until the modern era.
Another listener wonders, what accounts for the rise of the Alawites in Syria?
Well, so here we get...
Is this political or is this religious?
I think a lot of it's political. This minority was there for a very long time. The Ottoman authorities did not look at them with favor because they were quite heterodox and not properly Muslim. But the French recruited them because, again, under the principle of divide and rule, the French who took over Syria after the First World War as part of the spoils of war favored them and recruited them into the military. Often favoring minorities to offset the Sunni majority who is fighting for independence from French rule. And as a result, the Alawis played a disproportionate role in the military, which put some of them in a position then to seize power once Syria became independent.
Now, Saddam Hussein is often described as being a secularist, and yet after he was thrown out, we have heard about Shiites wanting to gain a certain amount of revenge because they were the majority and they felt suppressed. So was he a Sunni nationalist or was he really a secularist?
Well, he certainly described himself in the Ba'ath Party, which ruled Iraq, described itself as a pan-Arab secularist party and insisted on Iraq's uniform identity beyond religion and its Arab identity.
Well, didn't pan-Arabism actually start with Christians?
Among its early ideologues were a number of Christians, and then when the Ottoman Empire collapsed, it was embraced as an alternative identity by a lot of people. In the case of Iraq, yes, it has a Shi'i majority, which was deprived from power, but the regime's ideology also tried to downplay that. And I think it's important to remember the 1980s, Iran and Iraq fought a very bloody war. The majority of the military forces on both sides were Shi'is. Iraqi Shi'is in the Iraqi military and Iranian Shi'is. And despite that, most of those Iraqi Shi'is fought for their country, as they saw it, against fellow Shi'is. Now, of course, we see sectarianism run rampant and Shi'i militias and so on and bloody killings and ethnic cleansings over the last decade since the American occupation.
Listeners want to know about the similarities, if there are, between Wahhabism, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and what we're seeing in this new so-called Islamic State?
Well, I think they're quite different, and they come from very different places. Wahhabism comes from a preacher, a would-be reformer in the middle of the 18th century in the center of Arabia, a very isolated, backward kind of place, who allied himself with the Saud family, and they carved out a state for themselves with this very puritanical version of Islam.
Wasn't a deal struck between the Saudi leaders and the Wahhabis priests?
That's exactly.
Or imams?
Yeah, exactly. And although they were defeated then, because most Muslims thought they were, and the Ottomans thought they were crazy extremists, they returned and ultimately carved out the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Wasn't Osama bin Laden a Wahhabi?
Well, he grew up in Saudi Arabia, certainly, and partook of that ideology, but then went beyond it. He and his followers ultimately concluded that even the rulers of Saudi Arabia were apostates because they'd allied themselves with the United States, they were puppets of America, etc., and turned against them.
So he joined forces with somebody from the Muslim Brotherhood.
The Muslim Brotherhood had
Zawahiri.
A very different... Well, yes, but for Zawahiri, who's Egyptian, saw the Muslim Brothers as too moderate. And the Muslim Brothers comes from a very different place. This is a movement from Egypt, a much more economically and socially and culturally developed country. And if you look at the people who led the Muslim Brothers until the government in Egypt was overthrown last summer, these are lawyers, engineers, doctors coming from a very different place and talking about reform and at least avowing that they wanted to operate within a democratic process.
Where do the leaders of this new caliphate, Islamic State, fall in this? Are they closer to Wahhabis? Are they closer to Muslim Brotherhood? Are they a new approach or a new old approach?
In a sense, I think they're an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, right? Because they begin as the sort of Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda, the fighters against the Assad regime in the course of the uprising, the rebellion in Syria, who get the Al-Qaeda franchise, so to speak. But Al-Qaeda has disavowed them because they are so extreme. And denounce them. And then, of course, they linked up with forces in Iraq who were part of this Sunni insurgency against a Shi'i-dominated government.
A listener, Mary from Brooklyn, asks if there are any notable women contributors to Islam.
Absolutely. Of course, the vast majority of jurists and leaders were men. There are certainly instances of women jurists occasionally, but also some of the central figures, right, the prophets' wives, right, who have been seen as models for the community, and his daughter Fatima. Right? These are venerated figures and seen as very important. But it's also true that these societies tend to be rather on the patriarchal side, although with variations, of course.
Do Americans tend to lump everybody together because we have seen this wave of Islamophobia in the United States?
I think so. There's a great deal of ignorance. As you mentioned, and there were polls of this, right, with members of Congress and top officials not knowing the difference between Sunnis and Shiis. So the United States invaded Iraq and helped open this Pandora's box of sectarianism in a way by imposing a sectarian administration on a society where previously, in previous generations or previous decades at least, it wasn't deemed polite to ask whether somebody was Sunni and Shi, at least among the urban middle classes. And then what unfolded in the years that followed was, again, ethnic cleansing and slaughter in a way which was new.
Zachary Lachman is a professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History at NYU. And I thank you so much for being our guest on today's Please Explain, look at historical roots of religions in the Middle East.
Thank you.